You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Call us to join the conversation this morning at 800-838-3760 in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or you can send an email question during the live broadcast to jx@jeffnet.org. Just how hot will it get as climate change continues? What will rising sea levels do to coastal communities? These are questions Giles Slade considers in his book, American Exodus, Climate Change, and the Coming Flight for Survival. The book anticipates the disruptions that could take place if the warnings about climate change come to pass. He's the award-winning author of Made to Break and The Big Disconnect. He has advanced degrees in rhetoric and literature and describes himself as a recovering academic. Giles, welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you.
Well, tell me a little bit about the premise. We all know about climate change and some of the potential ways that it might play out. You're suggesting that it may produce an exodus, an American exodus. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, there are a variety of, extreme weather events that are happening with greater frequency and happening in more extreme ways because of regional climate change. And sea level rise, of course, is one of them. It affects the north east coast. It affects you right there in California and all the way up the west coast. There's also desertification in the southwest and river flooding in the Midwest. And basically all these events are going to become more severe and eventually reduce the habitability of places like California, Texas, New Mexico, New York, and Massachusetts all the way down to the Carolinas. So at that time, I guess, which is coming, and it's very soon, people are going to start looking for better places to go, and it's going to be a lot cooler and wetter in Canada and, I guess, along the Washington coast.
The whole idea of migration has certainly been with us since, I guess, human beings have been around. They've always had to make that transition. But, of course, in the last few centuries, we've been more tied to a particular part of the land as we've developed agriculture and stuff. So this would be something that would be unfamiliar to a lot of people, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, except, migration is the most common response to climate change, and climate change has been happening regularly, even here in North America. So, like, in the 30s, you have, the Dust Bowl, and 2.5 million people, left the Midwest and came to California. These kinds of things, I guess there was the Great Migration North from of black people from the South in the early 20th century. A lot of events like this, and so all I'm saying in the book really is that it's going to happen again.
One of the things that I read in your book, we've often thought about folks from Mexico coming to America looking for economic opportunities, which is, of course, true.
Yeah.
But you suggest that we're already seeing a migration north, and that can be tied to climate change. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I lived in Los Angeles in the 80s and 90s, and, I started noticing this huge influx of Mexicans and Central Americans around 1982. Around 1982, there was an economic collapse in Mexico, and it hasn't gotten any better since. But at the same time, gradual climate change was stressing the climates of northern Mexico, making it impossible for people to live from subsistence farming, which has always been their traditional sort of fallback. So they started pouring into Mexico City, which got too big, and then they started pouring into the United States. And now 25 million Mexicans live legally in the United States, eat, sleep, and work there. And that's about a quarter of the population of Mexico, 110 million people. So this thing is massive, and really it's already happening.
With us this morning, Giles Slade. He is the author of a new book, American Exodus, Climate Change and the Coming Flight for Survival. If you have a question for him about climate change, you can reach us anywhere by our toll-free number, 800-838-3760, here in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned lifeboat ethics. Can you explain what that is?
Well, after Hurricane Katrina, certainly during the Dust Bowl, other parts of America were unwilling to help the victims of these extreme weather events. So FEMA held off helping the people of New Orleans for a good long time. And there in California around the 1930s, the Yokies were just described as really unwelcome guests who were, you know, breaking the bank of California. And there was a lot of prejudice against them. And there were signs, I think, in places like King County that would say things like Negroes and Okies upstairs. These would be in the public theaters. And what was happening, I guess, of course, was that, you know, so many dust bowlers came that all the social services of California were sort of stressed to the maximum. People felt that their taxes were going on foreigners. And so they didn't want this to happen. And this is commonly what happens when there's a crisis like this and a whole lot of refugees, migrants, move to another area. People resent their presence. And I'm worried that this will happen in Canada unless we sit down and have a planned conversation about what's going to happen.
We're seeing the growing seasons moving further north. I know here here in southern Oregon in the Rogue Valley, they've developed quite the vineyards are back and they're expanding the different varietals that they can offer. Some impact on Napa Valley because of that. Are we going to see wheat fields across southern Canada sometime in the near future?
Well, that's that's the brightest sort of outlook. The trouble is there are drought prone regions of Canada, and those regions are going to become, I guess, more drought prone and larger. Here in British Columbia, like on the coast, because of global warming, the winds that prevail over the Pacific Ocean suck up more water and dump it down on the coast of North America, especially in BC, but also Washington and Oregon. So these places are going to have 30 to 40% more water in the coming century, and that's water is going to be the new gold. In a sense, we're ideal for growing crops, but this period of this sort of window of increased crop production isn't going to last very long because it's the continent is going to heat up more and more, and the heat is going to move further north.
On the phone with us this morning is Giles Slade, the author of American Exodus, Climate Change and the Coming Flight for Survival. We're looking at the impact that it may have and migration north as a way to respond to climate change. If you have a question, you can join us here. We'll be back with more and your questions right after this. Joining us this morning, Giles Slade, his new book, American Exodus, Climate Change, and the Coming Flight for Survival. Join the conversation this morning on the Jefferson Exchange from anywhere, 800-838-3760, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or your questions by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Giles, is there a broader conversation going on in Canada about the possibility of a migration north?
Well, I'm trying to start one, but most Canadians, I think, are frightened of the prospect of, several million Americans coming north. When I present the topic of the book, there's about 20 or 30% Canadians who have a sort of knee-jerk anti-Americanism and don't want anybody here and say, how can we stop this thing? And I don't think there's any way that we can stop it. We could try to build a fence like they have across, southern Arizona. Your border fence, I think, is 1,500 miles long.
Right.
We'd have to build a fence that was 5,500 miles long. I think what we should do instead is sit down and talk.
Let me ask a little bit about technology that kind of spins off of that. We've become so technologically reliant worldwide now. Will technology save us? Is that a bad attitude to have about climate change?
Yeah, I haven't seen anything that's, there's some really wild ideas out there, including, putting large mirrors in space to reflect the sunlight away from the earth, and I don't see anything that is really that hopeful or going to work. People talk about seeding the atmosphere with sulfur in order to create a volcano-like cloud, which will temporarily cool the Earth for a period of a couple of years. And this happened once during a volcano. It seems like we're monkeying with things that we don't know much about, and a lot of these ideas seem really far-fetched and kind of impractical. I think what we have to start doing is stop using carbon fuels and start scrubbing the atmosphere, and that's going to take an awful lot of effort and an awful lot of money.
We've seen in recent years some pretty big fires here across parts of North America. These have a tendency to have a profound effect on weather and climate. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, they've coined a new word to describe these the fires of the new millennium, and they call them mega fires. And I guess that started with the Witch Creek fire right there in California, you know, in the first decade of the 21st century. They're immense. They result from, too many trees drying out. Among other things, the trees are more dense than they ever were before because they haven't cut back the scrub. It's called the Smokey the Bear effect. And there's also, here in Canada, there's an infestation of mountain pine beetles, which kills off the lodgepoles and reduces them to kindling so that when the dry, hot weather comes, lightning strikes these trees, and they just they start a fire, especially a fire in regions where it's too hard to put them out, too hard to get the water there to put them out. So there's more and more of these things coming, and it's really very scary, and these things will make people move.
I know there's been a vigorous debate about harvesting, like beetle kill spruce.
Right.
Is this something that is going to have to be addressed? Is it, you know, some folks say just leave it there, that's the natural process, but have we moved beyond natural remedies for some of these situations?
I think we're beyond a natural remedy at the moment for the mountain pine beetle infestation. There doesn't seem to be very much that we can do about it. And unfortunately, you know, they infest trees in remote locations where it's very difficult to take out the dead trees and use them for, use them as timber or pulp and paper. I think, you know, some geneticist somewhere has to look hard at the mountain pine beetle make one that's infertile in the second generation, make a sort of dead cell kind of mountain pine beetle, and then begin reducing them that way. We really have to pull out all the tools in the toolbox to get rid of this thing. In the meantime, enormous fires are happening, and the biggest one seemed to happen here in Canada. There's there was one in the back country in Alberta. In the first decade of the 21st century, there was 1,700,000 acres, you know, and there was no way to get water in to put it out, so it just kept burning. And these kinds of things are just going to keep happening.
Here in the United States, we've put some tremendous demands on, for example, the Colorado River and the Ogallala Aquifer and some other smaller aquifers. How is that going to play out? I mean, some of that isn't even related to climate change. We started on that years ago.
Yeah.
Are you seeing any of that kind of thing going on in Canada as well?
Well, the drought is increasing in Canada. I mean, there's your Mississippi Basin, the water level is so low because of drought that shipping is really difficult through major shipping sites like St. Louis, and here in Canada, the Great Lakes region has reduced its water level as well, and that's going to affect shipping here as well, but it's also going to affect, the availability of water to a lot of the communities around the Great Lakes, both in the United States and in Canada. And we're already feeling the effects of this, and there haven't been any sort of plans put in place to do anything about it. I don't really know. Robert Kennedy Jr. calls the Colorado River, a train wreck, and I don't know if there's anything that can be done. It's terrifically sad. It's such a beautiful region of the country, but I don't know if there's anything that can be done to save it now. It's just been so overdrawn.
Ann joins us now from Eugene with a question. Good morning, Ann. You're on the air. Ann?
Hello.
Hello there.
Morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. Okay, the government in the United States at a federal level is controlled by the 1%. The 1% owns lots of coastal property. So how come they haven't done anything to promote the mitigation of climate change and in changing our carbon footprint? And my question is, if they're so rich, why aren't they smart?
Gee, that's a good question. Can I go ahead and answer that?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I think the 1% also owns, is really heavily invested in the infrastructure of the country, and especially, in the oil infrastructure of the country. Trillions of dollars of investment. So if we, stop the thing that stops climate change, our reliance on oil-based fuels, then they're going to lose a whole lot of money, which is, what drives climate denial. And as for how smart they are, I don't know. They're really good at making money. But they're not so good at, thinking about the future for their children and their grandchildren, which is, really why I wrote this book. I have three boys, and I just turned 60, and I'm concerned about the kind of life they're going to face in the 21st century.
Let me ask you a question that kind of is a little broader than that. I've heard a number of discussions where people have talked about if climate change is as severe as some of the predictions are, and we go about trying to mitigate that, that it would create a worldwide depression or economic collapse. Can you kind of address that issue?
Well, right there in California, you have like an economic historian called Sing C. Chu, and he's written three books about how the history of environmental collapse is always accompanied by economic collapse. It always happens this way. So the economy stresses the environment. The environment collapses at the same time, or slightly after the economy collapses. Easter Island and the Roman Empire and the Aztecs and everything else. So you can expect to see these two things in combination. And I think this is what's happening now. You're talking about the Ogallala Aquifer. We've drawn it down to such a point that water in some places has to be pumped from 3,000 feet below the surface, which is very expensive. And when the water gets to the top, it's contaminated with arsenic and cadmium because there's so little of it left. And this goes into, the drought conditions in the Southwest. So there's already too little water. And then there's too little water available from any other source, like the Colorado River or the Ogallala Aquifer. So agriculture becomes impossible. People stop breeding cattle and growing cotton in places like Texas. And then they have to move.
Do we see the potential for, of course, we know about the Dust Bowl back in the 30s.
Right.
With climate change and some of these areas drying out, the drawdown on the aquifers and what have you, could we see something like a Dust Bowl that could go on for centuries? Is that even possible?
Yeah, because I guess the temperature of the planet is heating up, the sort of La Nina conditions that created the Dust Bowl and that are creating the drought across the Southwest will become much more common and much more severe. So this drought now has lasted since, I think, 2008, maybe it's 2007, but certainly 2008. And people have pinned it on climate change, there's using probabilistic models. You will see it increasing and lasting. And, there will be years when it doesn't happen, when there will be a respite, when there will be, it'll be cooler, it'll be wetter, but then it will return to drought. So over the long haul, it's going to average out to be worse and worse drought.
We have a question from Pam in Dexter. Good morning, Pam. You're on the air.
Hi. Well, there's been an interesting development with the fossil fuel industries. Rex Tillerson, who's kind of famous for putting out a memo to, quote-unquote, create doubt about climate change, and then when he was asked about climate change and how he would react, he said, all I care about is making money, that's the bottom line. And that's kind of what the fossil fuel industry is notoriously known for doing, is just continuing on and trying to get as much money as possible before a carbon tax takes place. But recently, there was an article in the paper that said that they are the fossil fuel is gearing up to prepare for a carbon tax, knowing that it's inevitable. Meanwhile, the legislators are not, which is kind of interesting. So for me, it's like we need to put a lot of pressure on our legislators to do the right thing. It's already way too late to stop climate change. It's happening, but we want to mitigate it as much as possible and then prepare. And I have some friends that moved up from California about 10 years ago because it was just getting too hot, and they saw the writing on the wall about climate change and the inevitable dryness and unbearable heat down there. And then for southern Oregon, I had heard that the scientists had studied this area and said southern Oregon will basically be like Sacramento Valley. So so I guess my question for the guest is, what can we do, or in your view, to get our legislators, other than campaign finance reform and getting money out of politics so that the legislators work for the people, which is a whole other issue, what can we do today to get our legislators to really amp up the game and make some significant progress on dealing with climate change and preparing for it? And I'll listen on the radio. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Whoa. Yeah. Well, the first thing, you know, changing the rules about elections so that, you know, officials who are looking for a public office don't have to rely on the donations of large corporations like the oil barons. And that's a very positive step. And I guess it's a shame that your democracy is controlled by money. I mean, the people who have money are going to control to a large extent your democracy until there's a public will created that that people just say, no, we've had enough and we want really radical change now. And I guess there were great hopes for President Obama, but I guess he was sort of stymied by the whole process of people who had been elected from a group which is largely funded by the corporations. But still, now 70 or 72% of Americans actually believe in climate change. This is a radical change from when I started writing the book in 2009. There were only 30% of Americans. And even weirder, 58% of Republicans now believe in climate change, believe in man-made climate change, and believe we have to do something about it. So the political will is coming. It's just a very slow process, and unfortunately, I think we have to have, you know, two or three more major catastrophes, like Superstorm Sandy, that will convince people that they have to act now, and that's really the nub. You know, there needs to be a mobilization, and there needs to be the entire country behind it, like there was after Pearl Harbor, and I don't think that's going to come anytime soon. That's going to come when people get desperate.
Joining us this morning, Giles Slade. He is the author of American Exodus, Climate Change, and the Coming Flight for Survival. If you have a question, like to join the conversation this morning, you can call on our 800 line, 838-3760, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or send us an email, jx@jeffnet.org. I wanted to ask a question related to Superstorm Sandy. With the increasing sea levels or changes in climate from the research that you've done, is that going to be a bigger problem, major storms or rising sea levels? Or are they both going to be a problem?
Well, with Superstorm Sandy, the two problems go together. Right there where it happened, you know, on the upper northeast coast of the United States, there is what's called a sea level rise hotspot. So the melting ice from Greenland comes down the coast of North America, and somehow, I don't really understand this completely, but this is from an article in Nature, it pushes up the level of the ocean on the east coast, which is already a bit higher than the level of the ocean on the west coast. So you've got this this higher sea level, maybe about a foot higher, and then a storm surge comes in, and it's like, you know, this 200-mile-an-hour wind is acting like a bulldozer and pushing this huge wave into the shore. And, of course, the wave encounters this already 1 foot higher sort of level of shore sea level on the northeast coast, and it becomes a foot higher itself, or maybe slightly higher than that. So the storm surge becomes even higher. So they're really in a bad spot there in the most densely populated part of the country, and that kind of thing can't happen yet in California, although you can get storm surges that are quite big.
Of course, the Pacific waters are, depending on the latitude, I guess about 5 to 10 degrees cooler than the Atlantic at any given point, and that's probably got to help somewhat regarding that.
Right. La Nina conditions, of course, will increase the temperature, and as global warming increases, this will come further and further north. So you've got a bit of a delay, whereas they don't on the on the northeast coast. The North Atlantic is heating up, and once the I think once the sea level temperature rises above 30 degrees for 3 days, then you get some kind of North Atlantic hurricane, and these are going to increase in the next decade or generation.
We're speaking this morning with Giles Slade, the author of American Exodus, Climate Change and the Coming Flight for Survival. We're taking your questions at 800-838-3760, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, and by email, jx@jeffnet.org. A couple quick questions. We've got some folks on the line we want to talk to, but the projection, before we go to break, the projection is that we could see an increase in sea level by, I've seen different amounts. What are some of the numbers that you're seeing lately?
Well, I guess the IPCC says 1.5 meters by the end of the century. The IPCC is a very conservative group, and, you know, when I talk to different scientists, they say, several meters, and of course, if the... I guess if the ice fails in the Arctic and Antarctic, then it's, 9 meters.
Several questions from our listeners on the line, and we'll be back with those. We're going to take a short break, though, first. Again, we're talking with Giles Slade, an award-winning author and author of this particular book, American Exodus, Climate Change, and the Coming Flight for Survival. Back with your questions and comments right after the break. Climate change and the flight for survival, our topic this morning. Let's go to the phone lines right now. First, we have Scott, who is in Talent. Go ahead, Scott.
Hi, good morning. I want to ask your guest, has he given up his car? Has he given up heating his home? Has he given up desiring all of the trappings of modern life? Because in the end, unless you convince the entire world to not want to drive a car or fly in airplanes or go on cruise ships, or desire oranges in the winter, I guess I don't understand where all this is leading. What's the point? Because I don't see any kind of free energy supplies in the future, or unless we crash the population somehow. So I think there are many books like his on the market, but what is he offering realistically? And I don't think it has to do with politicians or evil energy companies, because we're all wanting these same things.
Yeah.
Giles, how do you achieve that sort of balance?
Well, good question, and I do have a car, and it's a Prius. I guess it's the best I can do. I own a house and I pay a mortgage. What I'm asking people to do in the book, I guess, is I feel that the political will has failed to accomplish change, and that we're really in personal jeopardy. In the immediate future, we will be in personal jeopardy in the immediate future. So what I'm trying to do is encourage people to look at the exits and find out where they are and, be prepared to act when bad things start to happen. Some people are already doing this. I think the previous guest mentioned that some of her friends saw the writing on the wall, moved to Southern Oregon from Southern California. Canada's getting more American immigrants already. We have 1 million American immigrants here. It's up to about 12,000 Americans applying for citizenship each year and 35,000 applying for work permits, which is the largest group of Americans that has ever happened in history before applying for immigration in Canada. During the Vietnam War, 500,000 Americans came here, 200,000 draft dodgers and deserters, 300,000 family members and friends. They had a huge impact on my country, And there's going to be an even bigger impact from the Americans who are coming now and who will come once climate change events become really extreme and frequent. And so I'm a bit of a hypocrite, but this is the best I can do.
Scott, do you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, I just don't think that people looking for somewhere else to move is not a solution. I mean, there's going to be if he's right, there's problems everywhere. There's drought in the Midwest. There could be lack of water in Southern Oregon if we don't have snow. So I just don't understand the point. Yes, I drive a car, but the only thing we can do is move somewhere else. What kind of answer is that?
What I'm saying is that people are going to move somewhere else. This is a trend that's going to happen in the near future, and it's an immediate human response to climate change. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying it's a great idea. I think a much better idea would be to mitigate climate change, but there doesn't seem to be the political will to do it.
All right, let's take another call. This is John now in Eugene. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Hi. As a meteorologist, I have pretty good understanding of the physics of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and I'm wholeheartedly supportive for numerous reasons of reducing our carbon footprints. I have to have some questions like the gentleman before did, but my real question is that even if we stopped emitting any CO2 right now, short of breathing perhaps, we got at least a 30-year lag before it has any impact on climate change. So what do we do, assuming we get the political will to stop emissions somehow? What do we do for 30 years while things continue on the path they are just because of the momentum? And I'll listen off the air.
Yeah, thank you. Great question. And the first thing we do is move to cooler climes and higher ground and hope that we have the 30-year window that that will enable us to mitigate the effects of carbon fossil fuels. But not only carbon fossil fuels, also methane that's being, because of global warming, is being released from, a variety of places, including the seabed in the Arctic. The methane ice is melting and just releasing in the atmosphere, and it has a much more severe effect than CO2. And there are fluorocarbons as well that have a much more severe effect. So we need, first thing, to find a space of about 30 years, a window of about 30 years, that will enable us to do our work. And we need, as I've said, the political will that will continue for over a generation to help us clean up basically our mess and survive. A lot of people, I guess I get accused of being very negative, but a lot of people call this the bottleneck, the second bottleneck, expecting a huge die-off of not only human beings, but also all biota. What I would like to believe is that, we're going to be able to survive this, but we should we should begin planning for it now.
David in Ashland has a question. David, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks. Excuse me. Thank you for the topic. Could the author describe what he knows, please, about the effects of thermohaline circulation and carbon sequestration long-term in the ocean driving the climate cycles of the planet? It seems to me the solutions that are being talked about in the short windows of time relative to the thousands of year cycle that it takes for the thermohaline circulation to go around the planet, it just seems like, just a pittance compared to what's actually happening.
Absolutely. I don't think I can add to that. 20 years is nothing in terms of, the geophysical history of the planet. But things are going to accelerate in a very bad way very quickly. So we need to find that window. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask, what about a lot of talk recently about the oceans being able to absorb a lot of the carbon in the atmosphere?
A disastrous kind of solution, because they're also absorbing the CO2 and acidifying, which is killing off, a lot of the biota in the oceans. So if we want dead oceans, we'll just leave it the way that it is. But what are we going to live off if we if we kill off the breadbasket and our agricultural centers? I mean, so we're at a point where biologists are calling it a massive die-off of most of the living things on the planet, and this is a very bleak future, which is why I'm looking for a kind of window that we can live in.
Let's go to Kathy in Grants Pass that has a suggestion about a book. Good morning, Kathy.
Hi, good morning. So the book title is Cows Save the Planet and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heal the Earth. It was published this spring by Judith D. Schwartz. And she talks about, a couple of different ideas, very exciting. One is the grazing project. Alan Savory is kind of world famous for using grazing for restoration, which is kind of a new idea for a lot of people. But that's also Wes Jackson's, I think it's called the Land Institute here in America, talking about using grasslands to help sequester carbon in the soil, rather than thinking about trying to plant trees, because apparently it's easier, to grow grass and it's less susceptible to the being destroyed by burning. But then she also talks about there's another project about the water cycles being interrupted, just causing a lot of the climate disruption because. Water gets, most of a human settlement is at the coastlines anyway, just historically, and because we have cities, we're blocking the soil from receiving the water that seeps down because of paving, and then also deforestation at the coastline is also reducing the traditional water cycles, which takes water into the forests and then from the rain off the ocean, and then it gets lifted up into clouds and then drifts inland and then drops it inland. So she's saying if we could really look at the water cycles, we could calm a lot of these disastrous storms. Anyway, it's a really great book. I'm sure a lot of people are skeptical about, for example, methane. She challenges the methane analysis that it's... I don't understand enough chemistry and understand her point on that, but increasing oxygen, reducing CO2, sequestering carbon, it's a really exciting ideas that could really help if people would take them up.
What about that, Giles?
Well, I'm all for sequestering carbon. We're up to, I think, 400 parts per million now, up from 380 about a generation ago. And there were these people in the 70s, a husband and wife team of anthropologists and city planners from, I think, the New York region, or maybe New Jersey, Mr. and Mrs. Popper. And they suggested a really radical solution, rewilding the plains. And part of rewilding was to return it to grassland. And, of course, there are varieties of grass that that resist extreme heat and extreme drought. Once you do that, it sequesters carbon, of course, and it also holds the topsoil in place so that, when a duster come along, and dusters have increased, in recent years, when a dust storm comes along, it won't blow the topsoil away. So I think, looking at ways of using the land that we're leaving to sequester carbon and to rewild the earth is a really good idea. And I don't know much about cows and methane, I'm sorry.
Well, I do know that there has been an effort to try to bring the tall grasses back to the plain states, of course, that were plowed under during the Dust Bowl era, and still trying to do that. We have John in Veneta with a comment or question about alternative energies. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I'm almost reluctant to bring it up because people have poo-pooed it for so long. And it vanished when Obama came in, and why, I don't know, but hydrogen. And it's the most abundant element in the universe, they say. The big problem is capturing and keeping it because it escapes. But on this very channel I'm listening to right now, I heard two different shows and I wish I'd wrote this all down. One of these guys was a scientist at MIT, and this other guy was some other scientist, some other big hoop-de-doo deal. And both of these guys had different methods. One, I think, was organic or bio, and the other one was some kind of metal pellets. And it created the hydrogen as you used it or required it. And I'd hate to be on the conspiracy side of things, but I cannot believe that we're still stuck in this mud. Go for it, guys.
All right. Your comment on that, Giles.
Yeah, neck deep in the big muddy, and the damn fool says to go on. You know, we are stuck, and you know, there are advances in solar energy. There's even a kind of nuclear reactor called a thorium reactor, a thorium modular reactor. That there, you have one in the United States. They're researching them in India and China. It the radioactivity biodegrades within 100 years. It provides nearly free power because it relies on a rich kind of sand called thorium that's very plentiful, and this would provide a lot of energy for communities. And but once again, we don't have the political will to do it. So and there are a lot of it's not really a conspiracy theory. I mean, it's just people protecting their investments. A company like Exxon doesn't want to spend a lot of money cleaning up the Gulf after it's, you know, spilled its oil all over the place. They just object to spending that much money, and I think that's how they think, and they don't want to modify that thought process, and won't modify that thought process until they're compelled to by law. I think that's what it is. So, but there are alternative energies out there, and I think, like the electric car, hydrogen has just been put on the back burner while we sell more oil.
Giles, we just have a short time left. I sometimes we end climate discussions on such a negative note, but can you give us like a positive look of what we can do as individuals or collectively to mitigate the problem?
Well, the first thing, what my book's all about is check out the exits, and make sure that you know a good place to move to. So, you know, take a visit to Canada, look around, take a visit to Washington and Oregon, you know, take a good look around. But also, you know, as one of your guests said, you know, start supporting politicians that have, you know, a really active policy of, limiting.
All right. Giles Slade, thank you for joining us today. The book is American Exodus, Climate Change, and the Coming Flight for Survival. That's it for today's exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. We also provide show topics and recordings on our Facebook page with the same links available on Twitter. If you're listening in the morning, the takeaway is coming up next. If you're listening to our evening rebroadcast, we'll be followed by the news from the BBC. The producer of the Jefferson Exchange is Charlotte Duren. We got production assistance today from student Reed Newland. I'm Milt Radford. Thanks for listening. We hope you'll join us again Monday at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.